Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Thanks for being here with us on this Friday afternoon. It's awful nice of you to spend the time, and we sure appreciate it. We got an internet open forum for you today. All the questions have come from the internet, and that means there's lots of good ones that we already know because we've already seen them. So lots of good questions to come. And a fantastic guest for the day, Jimmy Akin, both hours. Jimmy Akin, of course, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, where a new episode dropped this morning. Hello, Jimmy Akin.
Hello, Cyril Kellett. Very hello to you.
Very hello to you as well. And this morning, the In Search of Jesus' tomb dropped.
Yeah, that's right. We're looking at arguments that have been made by people about, did he even have a tomb? Some people have suggested no, they just would have chucked his body in a mass grave, or maybe even it didn't get that far. John Dominic Cresson proposed, maybe it was eaten by wild dogs after the crucifixion. He likes to be transgressive. But then there are people who have proposals that he's buried as far away as Japan, or was buried as far away as Japan, or in the Middle East, or three different sites in Jerusalem, which are favored by different groups of people. There's one that's commonly favored in the Protestant community. There's one that's commonly favored in the historic Christian communities, you know, that preceded Protestantism. And there's one that's favored by a very few avant-garde people today. But we're going to be looking at the historical evidence and seeing which, if any, the evidence actually points to as being the authentic tomb of Jesus. And there is one of them that is highly supported by the evidence.
You can check it out on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, mysterious.fm, or just put in Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World in your machine and you'll find it. Is St. Helena involved in any of this? I have not gotten to hear the episode yet.
She's actually not.
She's not. Okay.
Nope. All right. There is a common myth.
Yeah, that's what I wasn't
Helena,
sure.
Yeah, she was the mom of the Emperor Constantine, and she did go to the Holy Land and was involved in some of the holy sites. There's a myth that she was involved in the tomb of Jesus, but it's just a myth. She was not involved.
Yeah, we got the full Jimmy Akin treatment on that. Looking back, and yeah, because I know that I knew that there was some mix of myth and reality when it came to St. Helen. So, all right, well, that'll be fun.
Yeah, I try to be on the reality based side of apologetics.
Yeah, but I mean, even like stories that have elements of myth. What do we sometimes there's a grain of truth or
folklore?
Legend. The folklore or legend. Sometimes there is something in there that you can say, well, we know at least this much, but the rest of it got built up. All right, we got a bunch of questions for you, Jimmy, so I'm going to get right to them. Michael wants to know this. Are there any insights as to when Christ was using his divine intellect versus his human intellect, or is this a complete mystery, or is it incorrect to say Christ was not always using both?
Well, so in terms of his divine intellect, he uses that to keep the universe going. So he's always using the second person of the Trinity is always using his divine intellect. If he stopped using it, which would actually be impossible, the universe would cease to exist. When it comes to his human intellect, well, he used his human intellect as much as anybody else uses his human intellect. Now, it's going to depend on kind of how you define intellect. You might, for example, by that mean his conscious mind, and he would have been conscious whenever he was conscious, you know, not when he wasn't asleep and not dreaming. On the other hand, you could define human intellect in other ways. You could mean the calculating ability we have, and he would use that whenever he was doing mental calculations as a human. You also could broadly expand it to mean his human mind in general. And in that case, that's functioning all the time, because even when we're, you know, sedated, we have subconscious processes that are happening, that are mental in nature. And so, you know, he would always be using it in that sense. I suspect what Michael's asking, though, is not when were these intellects in use, but when were they in use as sources of information? You know, when was he drawing on information from his divine intellect? When was he drawing on information from his human intellect? And we actually have a pretty good sense of that, or at least we can have a pretty good sense of that, because according to the Catechism, he knew everything that pertained to his mission from his divine intellect. And his human intellect was employed whenever he, for example, needed to learn things in a human way, things, places where he admits to not knowing something. And so if we're asking when he was drawing on his human intellect as a source of information, it would be those passages where he indicates he doesn't know something, like when he asks, who touched me? You know, he was he was using a human mode of learning the answer to who touched me. Also, it would be passages like in Luke 2, where Luke says he grew in wisdom. That would be something that was possible for his human intellect, but not for his divine intellect. On the other hand, when he displays supernatural knowledge of his mission, like when he says, for this reason I have come, that would be information that he didn't simply learn in a human manner. I guess in some cases it could be if he like read a prophecy and reasoned from that prophecy that he was here to fulfill that. But in general, when he displays a consciousness of his mission and what he's doing, that would be information that came from his divine intellect.
Michael, thank you very, very much for that question. It's an internet open forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour. And this one comes from a different Michael. I would love to hear you comment on the theology of numbers.
Okay, so I assume here we're talking about the mathematical entities known as numbers, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so forth, not the book of numbers. Although, of course, the book of numbers does have its own theology, but I'm going to presuppose that's not what Michael's asking. For a long time, people have seen significance in numbers. This field is sometimes called numerology, and sometimes people will attempt to extract information from numerological sources. Like you could take your birthday, Cy Kellett, and add up the digits into a single number, and that would supposedly tell you something about Cy Kellett. Or you could give the letters of your name, Cyril Kellett, mathematical values, and then add up those numbers, and it would supposedly tell you something about you as a person. Personally, I'm extremely skeptical of this procedure. I'm not a believer in numerology. But some people will say, well, what about the numbers in the Bible? You know, don't some of them have special significance? And that's certainly been argued. I even have a book by a Protestant author named E.W. Bullinger called Number in Scripture, in which he tries to find a special meaning in basically, you know, all the numbers throughout the Bible. So he's got like a section on here's what the number 1 means and here's what the number 26 means and so forth. And he just goes through this list of numbers trying to find significance in them based on how they appear in the biblical texts. But I'm very skeptical of that approach. I think that it's possible that God has hidden significance in all of the numbers in the Bible, you know, on some deep level of the text. But I also think it's possible he hasn't done that. And even if he has hidden, you know, messages in the numbers in the Bible, I doubt that we're smart enough or that we have enough data to be able to retrieve those meanings. I think that the effort to do so, like what Bullinger does, is highly subjective and prone to error. However, it is clear that there are some numbers that do have a significance in the Bible and in Israelite culture more broadly. You know, the Bible being a product of Israelite culture, it's Israelite literature. Numbers like 1, 2, 3, and 4 are very common, and they have significance to a lot of people in a lot of different cultures. Now, not everybody has those numbers. You know, there are cultures where their counting system is 1 too many. You know, so they got the number 1, they got the number 2, and then after that, it's like many. And obviously, 3 and 4 wouldn't have significance in those cultures because they don't have those numbers. But in our culture, and in a lot of cultures, we have an open-ended counting system that goes on literally forever. And those small numbers, like 1, 2, 3, and 4, tend to be very prominent in our lives. They're useful numbers that we use a lot. You know, when you see four apples on a table, you would say, oh, here are four apples, as opposed to here are 10 to the 12th molecules. You know, four is a much easier number given the size of our minds for us to chunk things with. And so we read about things like the four winds, not the 24 winds, and the four directions, northeast, south, and west, not the 360 directions, one for each, you know, degree of a circle. And so we tend to use those smaller numbers a lot in a lot of cultures, including ours, to categorize things. Also, 10 is a special number in many cultures because we got 10 digits on our hands and on our feet. And that's why we use a base 10 counting system. Not everybody has done that, though. The Babylonians had a different counting system that wasn't base 10. And it's from them that we get a lot of fascination with the number 12 and 360, which is a multiple of 12. And the reason for that is 12 has a lot of prime factors in it. If you look at the prime numbers that go into 12, 12 is 2 times 2 times 3. And that makes it really easy to do fractions with 12. You know, you can divide 12 by 2. You can divide 12 by 3. You can divide 12 by 4. You can divide 12 by 6. You can divide 12 by 12. And so 12 is really useful for doing fractions. And that is part of why we use a 12-based system for circles, which have 360 degrees. It's also why we use 12 for clocks. And so then once you have significance attributed to some of these numbers, like 10 and 12, multiples of them tend to be significant as well. Like multiples of 10, like 100 and 1,000 tend to be significant. We often round things off to the nearest 100 or the nearest 1,000. Also, 10,000 and 12,000 are notable numbers. 12,000 is notable in the Bible because it's 1,000, that's a significant number, times 12, which was, among other things, the number of the tribes of Israel. So it occurred to me a number of years ago, and I've never seen anyone else do this, but a number of years ago, it occurred to me that there could be a way to do an objective test of which numbers in the Bible are significant. And this is related to a couple of principles in statistics. In statistics, there is a well-known principle known as Benford's Law. And according to Benford's Law, the leading digit, if you have a multi-digit number, the leading digit tends to be small. So, and this applies to loads of different data sets. It applies to electricity bills, housing prices, street addresses, all kinds of things. The leading digit of any one of these numbers tends to be small. So, for example, under Benford's Law, a street address is more likely to begin with a 1 than a 9. And this is so well established, and I don't know that we actually have a good explanation for why Benford's Law holds true, but it does hold true, and it's even used to detect accounting fraud, because if the numbers in a piece of accounting don't obey Benford's Law, there is a significant chance that fraud has been committed. There's also a related principle in statistics known as Zipf's Law. And according to Zipf's Law, how common an item is inversely proportional to its rank in an ordered series. So you rank things like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And the most common items tend to be at the lowest rank. So rank 1, that's the lowest rank. That's the most common thing. And then they get progressively less common from there. And what you can do with Zipf's Law is generate a kind of smooth curve from the most common things to the less common things. And so I decided to do something kind of like Benford's Law and Zipf's Law, only with the Bible. So I used Bible software to extract all of the numbers from the Bible. In the biblical text, not the verse numbers. Those are added later. But I extracted all of the numbers in the base text in Greek and in Hebrew, And unsurprisingly, the number one was the most common number, just like you'd expect from Zipf's law. Number two was the next most common number, and number three was the third most common number. And I charted how common the numbers were, and then what I got this smooth curve, just like you would expect, except there were certain bumps on the curve, and that's what I was looking for. The numbers that were more common than you would expect given their rank. Because if they're more common as a number than what you would expect, then that suggests they had special cultural significance in Israelite culture. And so that way I'm not doing a everything must be significant. I can say, okay, well, no, sorry, the numbers 1, 2, 3, and 4 are exactly where you'd expect on the curve. So they don't have any special mystical significance. They're important numbers that humans use a lot, but they're not really having any mystical significance here. But there were certain numbers that, yeah, and 10, you know, would be a bump because the Israelites, like us, used a base 10 counting system. So, of course, they're going to round things off to 10. 10 is going to be more common than 9 or 11. But if you look at numbers that don't fall into that pattern, there are a few that do have extra prominence, numbers like 7 and 40. And so I think we can objectively say that even though we can't attribute a special significance to every number in the Bible, certain numbers like 7 and 40 do have special significance in Israelite literature. And it's not hard to see what that significance is. Both 7 and 40 are used to suggest a kind of completeness. You know, there are 7 days in the week, for example. And so that represents a complete week. And we see the number 77 used in various passages in a way that's consistent with completeness. Like it says, you know, when you stumble, God will lift you up 6 times. Yes, 7 times he will raise you, meaning God's always going to raise you if you're one of his followers. Similarly, 40, that's the number of days that rain fell. That was the complete rainfall record in the flood. It was the number of years the Israelites spent in the desert. It was the complete time in the desert. It was the number of days Moses spent on the mountain by himself. It was his complete time on the mountain. And so you see these special numbers like 7 and 40 do have a special significance in Israelite literature. They tend to be associated with completeness. And so while there are identifiable numbers like this in the Bible, you know, we see most of the numbers in the Bible obeying standard statistical laws, which would suggest that most of the numbers in the Bible do not have special significance. They may, I mean, one is as significant to the Israelites as it is to anybody else. And of course, they had one God that they worshiped. But it's not like the number one is always associated with God. Sometimes, you know, to quote Sigmund Freud, a cigar is just a cigar, and sometimes one apple is just one apple.
Michael, thank you very much for the question. Jimmy, I don't know if you mentioned, I may have missed it. Did you publish this study somewhere?
I have not published it, but I plan to someday.
Oh, okay. Very good. Michael, again, thank you very much for the question. This question comes from Joe. If God is the God of all, how can he have a chosen people?
Well, it's kind of like, I mean, I can approach this a couple different ways. One way is it's kind of like, well, all of the clothes in your wardrobe are your clothes. You know, you're the owner of all your clothes. But you can still choose one thing to wear on a particular day. You might even have one thing that you choose to wear on particular occasions, like a suit of clothes for going to church on Sunday or something like that, or a tuxedo to wear at weddings or fancy parties. And in the same way, God is the God of all peoples, but he chose the Israelites for specific purposes. He chose them to have a special relationship with him, And that's also something you can do. You can choose to have a special relationship with one person, but not another. You know, Cy Kellett, you're a friend of mine, I would say. Mm-hmm. And so I have a special relationship with you that I don't have with some random person you pick out of a phone book, if phone books are even still a thing anymore. That, however, doesn't mean that I can't treat both you and a random person fairly. You know, I can try to be, I want to love my neighbor. I can try to be fair to anybody I meet, whether I know them or not. I can try to be loving to anyone I meet, whether I know them or not. But I do have a special relationship with you because I know you and you're a friend. And in the same way, God chose the Jewish people to be his special people that he would work with and that he would bring knowledge of himself to everyone in the world through. They're meant to be, as a nation, a light to the Gentiles. They take knowledge of the true God and they broadcast that knowledge to the Gentile nations. And so, yeah, we see God being a God of all peoples, but he has a special relationship with the Jewish people that includes a special purpose for them. He's going to use the Jewish people to educate all of the nations of the world about himself. And so we see in that how both sides of this relationship. Yes, he's the God of all people. He's going to make sure that all people get knowledge of him. And he also has chosen the Jewish people to be the means through which that knowledge will go to all the different nations.
Joe, thank you very, very much for the question. It's an internet open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Lots of great questions today. This one will require a little reading on my part. Matthias asked this: God gave us the gift of free will, but by my understanding, it is the only gift he cannot take back or overrule. Otherwise, our will would not be truly free. With this in mind, how are we to understand his words in Exodus, where he seems to make Pharaoh obdurate, as though overriding the free exercise of his will? For example, in Exodus chapter 7, verses 3 and 4, "Yet I will make Pharaoh so headstrong that despite the many signs and wonders that I work in the land of Egypt, Pharaoh will not listen to you. Therefore, I will lay my hand on Egypt, and with mighty acts of judgment, I will bring my armies, my people, the Israelites, out of the land of Egypt."
So free will is a gift of God, and in this life, he's not going to take it back. Hypothetically, he might overrule it in some cases, in which case you would not be responsible for what you do if God is overriding your free will, just like you would not be responsible for what you do if someone, you know, let's say the CIA, as part of their MKUltra program, injects you with a drug and overrides your free will. You just wouldn't be responsible. So when it comes to Pharaoh, well, hypothetically, one could propose that God did override Pharaoh's free will on some occasions. It's often been noted, though, that even though God predicts he's going to make Pharaoh hard of heart, before he actually does that, Pharaoh hardens his own heart. If you look at Exodus 8:15 and 8:32, it says Pharaoh hardened his heart, and that's before the first time God hardens Pharaoh's heart in Exodus 9:12. So some people have understood this as, well, Pharaoh rejected God twice on his own, and then God withdrew his grace and left Pharaoh in his hardness, and that's what this means. And so, you know, the idea here would be, if you just continually reject God, he may not continually give you the grace to turn to him and the grace to do his will. You need to respond. And if you do respond, well, then he won't abandon you. He'll always keep giving you grace. But if you just reject God's initiatives, he may say, okay, well, I'll leave you as you are then. However, I think there's also another possibility with this, which is that the Israelites had a manner of speaking that basically attributed everything to God, and they ignored other factors. This was a way of glorifying God and promoting his sovereignty, you know, emphasizing his sovereignty by making it sound like he himself directly did everything. even though we know that God sometimes uses secondary causes. And so it's possible that all this prediction really meant was it's just describing what's going to happen. Pharaoh is going to be headstrong, and God will bring Israel out of Egypt despite the fact he's headstrong. But it may not literally mean that God hardened Pharaoh's heart. It may just be the Israelite way of talking about events as if God did everything, and we're not meant to take that literally. There's also a role for secondary causation, like Pharaoh's own hardening of his will.
Matthias, thank you very, very much for the question. It's an internet open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. We've got lots and lots of internet questions to come. So hang on. More of that right after this on Catholic Answers Live. When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
Is relativism dead? It sure seems dead. Each day, new moral demands are made and they are presented to us as absolutes. Everything from transgender ideology to physician-assisted suicide is presented as a moral good that all right-thinking people must accept. But Catholic Answers' own Carlo Broussard says look deeper, and you will see today's moralism is just relativism dressed up in new clothes. Carlo's eye-opening book, The New Relativism, shines a light on how the sacred moral teachings of this age cover up a deep denial of moral truth. Order your copy of The New Relativism today at shop.catholic.com and be prepared to defend the truth against aggressive relativism. The New Relativism at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
When have you been blessed by a stranger?
You can tell us your story Monday on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie on most of these EWTN stations.
Now back to Catholic Answers Live with Cy Kellett.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Hey, you still looking for that perfect Christmas gift for your loved one? Look no further. Shop.catholic.com. Store-wide sale has just the right item for everyone on your list. Hundreds of items at 10 to 25% off, and in some cases, more than 25% off. Too late to get something in the mail? No problem. We've got hundreds of ebooks, e-magazines, MP3s, and digital videos. Another great option is our online school of apologetics courses, and the newest one of those is Jimmy Akin's course, Evidence for Christ. What are you waiting for? Get on over to shop.catholic.com today and let the savings begin. Not a single odd phrase in there. Carrie didn't give me anything weird to say.
But you failed the challenge.
Oh, I thought it was for the whole show. I didn't know it was for the ad.
Oh, well.
I apologize, Jimmy.
Okay. Well, you missed a great opportunity. Because I challenged you in the break to use the word absquatulate.
Yes.
Which, as we've covered, means get up and go somewhere. Get up and leave.
Yeah.
And so you had the opportunity. It was right there. You could have said, so what are you waiting for? Absquatulate over to the store and let the savings begin.
You see, Jimmy, I misunderstood the challenge. I apologize.
Okay.
I could have done it in the ad.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Challenge failed. I almost gave out the phone.
Next time.
Yeah, next time. I will make sure I fit absquatulate in there somewhere.
Okay.
Please don't defenestrate me.
I won't.
All right, thank you.
You're on the first floor anyway. I don't have any...
Right.
Defenestrating you wouldn't do much good.
Plus, you can't break these windows in here. Somebody tried to do it once. And
yeah.
You would really hurt me if you tried to throw me through one of these windows.
That's what, for people who may not be aware, that's what defenestrate means, to throw someone out a window.
Yeah. Brian wants to know, it's an internet open forum. And Brian sent this question, Jimmy. It seems like miracles are less known than they should be. Example, Fatima, St. Pio, Borang. I'm not sure. I'm in the category now of not knowing that one. And others. Do you think the evil one obfuscates the message?
Okay, and just so Benno and Borang, and forgive my pronunciation, but there were a couple of European apparitions in the 20th century.
Okay.
Well, so I'm sure the forces of darkness are pleased that these aren't better known, and they may be playing some role in that, but I don't think it's primarily due to the forces of darkness. I think it's due to a broader cultural trend. You know, there are three sources of evil. Classically, there's the world, the flesh, and the devil. The world is just trends in society.
Mm-hmm.
The flesh is our own personal temptations, and then the devil is the third. And whenever you say, well, why is this bad thing happening? You don't want to leap to the demon hypothesis. It gives the devil way too much credit. And so you want to say, well, is there anything else? Are there personal temptations that would cause people to not, you know, pass on word of miracles? Well, maybe, you know, but I think in this case, it's the world that's the big reason that miracles and apparitions are not better known, because there is a prominent skepticism and secularism that is out there in our cultural mindset, in our cultural zeitgeist. And this applies not just to religious miracles, it applies to other paranormal things. If you go to universities, a lot of academics have a very reductionistic, materialistic mindset that would downplay and dismiss anything of a paranormal nature, whether it's religious or psychic or whatever it may be. And so I think that's just a cultural trend that's out there. It's part of the world, to use the classic threefold definition, and so or threefold explanation of the sources of evil. And so I think the problem in this case is primarily the world.
Brian, thank you very, very much. Appreciate that question. This one comes from Chad, and I have to say I am very happy to have this question. I've wondered about this, and I've never asked you about this, Jimmy.
Really?
Yeah, I've thought,
okay,
because occasionally I see you engaging in this activity, and I meant to ask and have just neglected it. Question from a fellow pipe smoker. What's your favorite pipe and tobacco?
Well, I have a lot of different pipes and different styles. You can see some of them here in the background if you're watching on video. I generally prefer bent pipes rather than straight pipes for a few reasons. They're more comfortable in the mouth, and they don't spill as easily as straight pipes do. I also just think they look better. My favorite shape is what's known as a billiard. And so I prefer bent billiard pipes. And I'm holding one up if you're watching the video. In fact, the shapes actually have numbers in the trade industry. So you can specify the exact shape you like by number. And even though I have lots of different shapes, I even have a Navajo pipe that you can't see over on the wall next to me. My favorite shape is 606KS. The KS stands for king size, meaning it's a larger pipe, and the 606 is the bent billiard shape. So that's my most favorite kind of pipes. I have more 606KSs than I have any other kinds. When it comes to favorite tobaccos, well, I get tobacco from a tobacconist. I mean, you can't hardly get them in most stores now like you could when I was growing up. I mean, I remember you could get them in drugstores and grocery stores and all kinds of places. I remember when I was a kid, my dad would send me down to the corner grocery store to pick up pipe tobacco for him. That would never happen today.
No.
Not with a 7-year-old kid picking it up for his dad. But So I actually get my tobacco from tobacconists. And so it's a higher grade than what you would get if you just went to a supermarket or a drugstore or a smoke shop. Smoke shops are not the same things as tobacconists. The two that I use most often currently, one of them is, I think it's called Rustin's Retreat, but what it is basically a professional grade version of a dime store quality tobacco known as Captain Black. Captain Black is the most popular dime store quality tobacco. But because it sits on a shelf for a really, really long time, they've put preservatives and things in it, and it can get dried out on the shelf. So it's not as moist as one would want. And so tobacconists have essentially the same thing. It's the same tobacco. It's just without all the preservatives, and it's not stored in such a way that it dries out. So it's actually better.
Mm-hmm.
The other is a custom blend that I have a tobacconist make for me. In Germany, there is a tobacconist that produces a kind of tobacco called Devil's Holiday. And Devil's Holiday is a little drier than I like. It also has, elements of like fruit notes in it, like cherry and blackberry and things like that.
Yeah.
So it's sweeter. And I like that about Devil's Holiday, and I could get it in California, but there's some kind of tax fight between Arkansas and Germany over this. And so you can't get it here. So I had a local tobacconist basically make a close approximation of it. And only since I'm not a fan of the devil, I requested that it be renamed as St. Michael's Holiday.
Oh, nice.
And so he's actually got, this is at Ash and Ember in Siloam Springs, Arkansas. But he's actually got it as part of his regular rotation now. So not only can I go pick it up, but other people can enjoy it as well.
Ah, so interesting. I think Chad did not ask the obvious question, which I will ask shortly, but it's interesting to hear you talk about it. Is there a sommelier of tobacco? Like, you know how, like the way you talked about it, it sounded like the way people talk about wine. Is there a job that?
There are. That's one of the things that tobacconists and tobacco blenders will do.
Uh-huh.
Is they will talk about the different qualities of the tobacco, just like people talk about the different qualities of wine and how it's mixed and how it's prepared and things like that.
I mean, I do think the obvious question, Chad, that you missed is, can you blow smoke rings?
I have, but I haven't practiced it.
Oh, all right. All right. All right.
Smoke rings are not what it's about for me.
Unlike Bilbo and Gandalf, you're not interested in the smoke ring sport. All right.
Not enough to have practiced it.
Chad, thanks very much. We'll take a quick break. Be right back with more Internet Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
The most original Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
On Mother Angelica Answering the Call, Father Joseph and Doug Keck mine decades of phone calls answered by Mother Angelica. No subject is off limits and no problem too big. for the wisdom and compassion of the one and only Mother Angelica.
Mother Angelica, answering the call, Sunday afternoon, 2 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour and next for an internet open forum. And I have to admit, I wish Mark Brumley were here because I would like to hear a debate between the two of them on the following subject. Both experts in this field, both extraordinary apologists, but experts in this field. So Rogerio asks this important question.
I think it's Rogerio.
Rogerio. Oh, I apologize. Which is the best government? The United Federation of Planets from Star Trek or the United Planets from Legion of Superheroes?
Well, in both cases, we don't really know a huge amount about how these governments work. So we're kind of at a disadvantage from that perspective. So I would say if you look at, it's going to depend on the which iteration of Star Trek or which iteration of the Legion of Superheroes, which is my favorite comic book of all time. I don't know that Mark is actually an expert on the Legion, but he definitely knows a lot about Star Trek. But both the Legion and Star Trek have different continuities. So like periodically they reboot it. So like in Star Trek, you have the main timeline, but then you have these alternate timelines. And in the Legion, they've a few times rebooted their history and started from scratch. But I would say that if you look across, you know, the history of the Federation in Star Trek since Star Trek started in the 1960s, and if you look across the history of the Legion since it started in the 1950s, I would say the United Planets has been more successful in terms of having a post-scarcity civilization. Star Trek also has a post-scarcity civilization, but the Legion has a long-standing one, and it also seems to have kept the peace better. The Federation keeps getting into major wars, and the United Planets doesn't. They've had some skirmishes, but they tend not to be as big or last as long. Also, the Federation has known corruption at high levels. You know, that becomes a regular plot point. You have a whole series of bad admirals that show up. And while admirals aren't members of the government, it does indicate the kind of rot that, you know, they say the fish rots from the head. And so if the Federation Council is not ensuring ethical behavior on the part of admirals in Starfleet, that's kind of on the Federation Council, because the military answers to civilian authorities. And if you have a just string of bad admirals, that's ultimately the fault of the civilian government. Also, there are regular problems with the civilian government in Star Trek. You know, whenever, if you watch the original series, whenever they've got a Federation ambassador there, the Federation ambassador is essentially the guest idiot of the week, who is going to insist that Captain Kirk do stupid stuff that's going to drive the plot forward, but also causes problems. So, you know, and ambassadors are government officials. They're government appointees. But you don't see the same kind of corruption in the United Planet. So I'd have to say if I had to live under one government or the other, I'd probably prefer to live under the United Planets than the United Federation of Planets.
Rogerio, thank you very much for that question. Jimmy, I feel like the obvious question is missed. If a time traveler from Section 31 were to try to enlist you, would you join Section 31 or no?
I can neither confirm nor deny.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Did I do the break this time? Because sometimes I forget the break lately. Okay. I did the break. All right. Chris has this question. Is there any chance Our Lady of America is coming back from the disapproval of the diocesan bishops?
Okay, so for people who may not be familiar, Our Lady of America is a series of revelations that were reported by Sister Mildred Neuziel between 1956 and 1959 here in the United States. Our Lady of America reportedly requested, among other things, that a statue of her be placed in the National Basilica of the Immaculate Conception in Washington, D.C. Sister Newsil had these revelations in like six different dioceses, and that creates a complication for evaluating them, because ordinarily it's the local bishop who is the point person by law to investigate apparitions occurring within his diocese. But when you got six different dioceses involved, who's supposed to handle that? And so the bishops of those dioceses ended up asking the Vatican, maybe y'all would like to investigate these. And the Vatican said, nope. They said, instead, one of y'all should take the lead, you know, with the consent of the others, or you could find an outside bishop to take the lead. The bishops then discussed it, and they ultimately appointed Bishop Kevin Rhodes to do an investigation of the apparitions. And he published his evaluation, I want to say in like 2019, it's just been within the last few years. And he concluded that the apparitions that Sister Newsil reported are mostly Orthodox, although they did contain at least one thing that the bishop identified as a doctrinal error. It said that Saint Joseph with Christ was a co-redeemer, and that was regarded as a doctrinal error. Also, his conclusion was that Sister Newsil's own imagination and intellect was involved in these experiences, and they would be better classified as religious experiences than as objective private revelations. The basic distinction here is a religious experience would be something of a lesser order. It could still be a genuine experience, but it would be a lesser thing than an objective private revelation where the external revealing agency imposes itself on your experience in a more forceful way, so that you're not, your own intellect and imagination are not as involved in shaping and crafting the experience. So he concluded that it would be best categorized not as a private revelation, but as an inner religious experience that Sister Newsil had. And consequently, he judged that it cannot be said to be of supernatural origin. That's the non constat de supernaturalitate judgment. And consequently, he didn't think that that public devotion should be approved. And although he thought that previously approved private devotions could continue. So the basic idea here is, like, if you're wearing an Our Lady of America medal, you can continue to wear it, but we don't want public devotion, meaning like under parish auspices. So don't include Our Lady of America if you're doing a litany of Marian titles or something like that in a parish. A year or so after his judgment, the other bishops concurred. So all seven of the bishops had a joint letter they all signed that basically signed off on Bishop Rhodes's conclusions. Is it possible that this could one day be reversed? Yeah, it's possible, but it's unlikely, because it would involve mounting a very significant investigation, and that's going to be harder in the future than it was now. And because, you know, the witnesses are, there aren't going to be as many witnesses in the future that you could talk to. And generally, the church is very reluctant to overturn a ruling once the ruling has been made. So it's possible, but I think it's very unlikely that this would be reversed in the future.
Thank you very much, Chris, for the question. I hope that that was helpful to you. On we go. It's an internet open forum, and this one comes from Gloria. Please discuss metaphor and actuality of new heaven / new earth. Who will live there? The need for a new earth, and whether it's metaphorical, has been discussed more than a new heavens. What is wrong with the old heavens?
Okay, so in the Old Testament prophets, there is a mode of language that has sometimes been called cosmic catastrophe language, where it involves elements of the cosmos being described as if they're radically changed, like you know, the sun will be darkened and the moon will turn to blood and the stars will fall from the sky and there will be a new heaven and a new earth. And it's very clear that in some cases, this is metaphorical. For example, there's one passage in Isaiah that uses exactly this language. This is earlier in Isaiah. It uses this language about the sun darkening and the stars falling and stuff. And then it reveals what the prophet is talking about. God says, behold, I'm going to bring the Babylonians against this people. So what's happening is God's describing a war that's going to happen. And the effect of that war will be like living through the sun darkening and the stars falling out of the sky. It's going to be that kind of catastrophe for the nation and it's that experiences the invasion, and it's going to be as if that stuff happened. So that cosmic catastrophe language is frequently metaphorical, and that's been recognized all the way down through church history, or through Judeo-Christian history. If you read, for example, the book by Moses Maimonides, who was a medieval Jewish scholar. He's kind of like the Jewish Thomas Aquinas. He wrote a book called, which has a great title. It's called The Guide for the Perplexed. And he talks about, he has a whole chapter about this mode of language, and he talks about it being metaphorical. It's like an externalization onto the world of the psychological state of the people who lived through this experience. And similarly, he talks about the new heaven and new earth phraseology, which appears later in Isaiah, as meaning basically just a radically changed and improved situation. So you could say, for someone who's like really been down on his luck and now God blesses him and everything is going his way, you could, in this ancient mode of language, say it was a new heaven and a new earth for him, meaning it's like everything changed for him. It was radically better. And so there is a metaphorical use of this language in the Bible. The question then becomes, well, what about at the end of the world? You know, what's going to happen there? Will it literally be a new heaven and a new earth in the sense that God is going to destroy the current earth and, you know, annihilate it, send it to nothing, and make a new one out of nothing? Is he going to do that with the cosmos, with the heavens? Is he literally going to annihilate it and make a brand new one? Or is this a reference to a renovation where things are just going to be radically upgraded? Both of those possibilities have been entertained. If you look at the Catechism of the Catholic Church, though, it seems to favor the renovation theory. So it doesn't seem to favor the annihilation and recreation theory. The Catechism seems to envision the change of the world that's coming as God renovating it. Now, that's because this is the final renovation. It would presumably be very dramatic and could involve the all kinds of stuff. Like, we're going to be immortal after this. We're not going to have pain and suffering after this. So this is a truly radical upgrading. But it looks like, at least the Catechism makes it look like it's not an annihilation and recreation. In terms of what's wrong with the old heavens, well, I don't think anything's really wrong with them. I think that on the renovation model, when you say there's going to be a new heaven and a new earth, what it really means is that it's going to be much better than it is now. And the focus in the book of Revelation, where it talks about this, is not so much on what's going on in the heavens, but what's going on the new earth where mankind lives. And it says the dwelling place of God is now going to be with man. And that's the key thing. We're not going to be separated from God anymore. We're going to be spiritually united with him. So it depicts God as coming down out of heaven to live with man. But ultimately, there's nothing wrong with the old heavens.
Gloria, thank you very, very much. Appreciate the question. Thank you to everybody who sent their questions in. We've got a whole bunch more coming the second hour. It's an internet open forum with Jimmy Akin, who I now call Jimmy 606 KS Akin. That's my new nickname for you.
Okay.
And we'll be right back with more right after this on Catholic Answers Live.